Topic number 2. Last month, in AUDIO LETTER NUMBER 21, I explained what the words national security really mean to those who control America's government today. To them, national security begins and ends with the protection and the advancement of our unelected rulers themselves, not you and me. Nowhere is this more vividly proven than in the realm of war. We are taxed to the breaking point in order to support so-called national security. But when in this century has all of this prevented a war? And for all our vaunted intelligence gathering and early warning systems, when have you and I ever benefited by being warned in advance of an imminent conflict by the government? It has been proven beyond question, not only by circumstantial evidence, but by documentary evidence as well, that every single major conflict in the 20th century involving America has been known about in advance by our rulers. But this advanced knowledge has never been communicated to us, the nation at large, except once. In 1962, President John F. Kennedy did notify America of the warnings he had obtained of the imminent Cuban missile threat. It was a frightening experience for us all, but the result was that a successful Soviet surprise attack was rendered impossible. Barely a year later, Jack Kennedy died at the hands of the CIA for ruining this Rockefeller Soviet gamble by acting in the interest of true national security, our security. But in the cases of two world wars, Korea and Vietnam, a different pattern has consistently applied. In 1916, Woodrow Wilson, the first American president to be a total puppet of the Rockefeller Empire, narrowly achieved re-election with the peace-oriented slogan, "He kept us out of war." Meanwhile, he was rapidly maneuvering America into war. 5 months after his re-election on April 6, 1917, America declared war on Germany, and soon American doughboys were off to fight the war to end all wars. There thousands died in trenches while trustees of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace encouraged Wilson to extend the war because of the desirable changes it was producing in American lives. In 1940, with Europe once again aflame with war, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, like Wilson before him, appealed to peace sentiment in order to be re-elected. Even now, my friends, I can still hear those campaign words of FDR ringing in my ears. And I quote, "And while I am talking to you mothers and fathers, I give you one more assurance. I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." Unquote. But even as he won an unprecedented third term in this way, FDR was moving the United States rapidly toward war. On May 27, 1941, only 6 months after his re-election, and with Pearl Harbor still 6 months in the future, FDR proclaimed an unlimited national emergency to get ready for war. In the ensuing months, everything possible was done to provoke a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And when this attack was known to be imminent, most of the United States Pacific Fleet was conveniently bottled up in Pearl Harbor as a tempting target. Only our aircraft carriers were kept far away from danger, since they would be indispensable for retaliation against Japan. Certain officials in the American government knew well in advance that war with Japan was coming. Proof of this can be found in many places today, some of them quite unexpected. One example is the autobiography of the Right Reverend Edward Randolph Wells II, published by Learning Incorporated, Mansett, Maine, 04656. The book, entitled The Happy Disciple, is not basically about politics or economics at all, but about the career and life of an Episcopal minister. But it so happens that in the fall of 1941, Bishop Wells was the rector of Christ Church in Alexandria, Virginia, the Church of George Washington. And on page 62, one reads the following, and I quote, "Another of my friends was Norman H. Davis, president of the American Red Cross, who was elected to our parish vestry. He was very close to President Franklin D. Roosevelt and saw him frequently. On November 6, 1941, I had lunch with Mr. Davis in Washington and learned of the approaching war with Japan, which would begin within 5 weeks. I was shaken and asked Mr. Davis to urge the President to appoint a National Day of Prayer, and handed Mr. Davis a letter I had written to President Roosevelt on the subject. Mr. Davis did hand my letter to the President, who did appoint the following New Year's Day as a National Day of Prayer. I was so moved by the luncheon revelations that later that very day I sent our mimeograph postal cards to the congregation stating, the rector is preaching a sermon at 11 a.m. service on Sunday, November 9th, which he feels is sufficiently important to call to your attention. The sermon will assess the desperate situation that confronts America this Armistice Day and suggests basic Christian attitudes and actions. On Sunday, in the course of that sermon, I said, few people realize how great is the possibility that we shall actually be at war with Japan within 30 days. The congregation was deeply shocked, and in response to many requests, my booklet of sermons was reprinted with this sermon added. 28 days after that sermon came, December the 7th, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and the war was on." End of quotation from Bishop Wells' autobiography. Bishop Wells, of course, had no way of knowing that President Roosevelt's advanced knowledge of the impending Japanese attack was due to conspiracy to bring about that attack. But he did know that people should be warned about it, and he did just that. The federal government, of course, could have warned all of America of the impending Japanese attack, but then the attack would never have taken place. And FDR, doing the bidding of the Rockefellers and their allies, wanted the attack to take place so that America would go to war. In the 2-volume audio book talking tape I recorded a year ago with Colonel Curtis B. Dowell, the detailed story of Pearl Harbor is told by Colonel Dowell. And Colonel Dowell, who was the son-in-law and close friend of FDR, knows what he is talking about. Next came Korea. On June 21, 1950, Assistant Secretary of State Dean Rusk testified before Congress to the effect that there was no indication of any impending North Korean attack on South Korea. Several days later, John Foster Dulles went to Seoul, South Korea, to give reassurances that there was no danger of invasion from the North. Then he left quickly, because the North Korean invasion was already being launched. As for us, the American people, another nasty surprise. Vietnam, too, followed the old pattern. The last thing the American people wanted was yet another bloody war. And during the election campaign of 1964, Lyndon Johnson knocked down straw man Barry Goldwater by playing on the peace theme. Goldwater was portrayed as the dangerous man who would get America into a big war, Johnson as the great compromiser who would keep us away from any such danger. But Johnson had already obtained the Tonkin Gulf Resolution as the tool he needed, and within 3 months after his landslide election, Johnson started turning Vietnam into another big, disastrous war. By June 1965, the commitment of American combat troops to the nightmare of Vietnam had begun under the orders of one more president who had promised America peace and prosperity. Today, it is all happening again. Jimmy Carter, the puppetized president who works for David Rockefeller, is raising many Americans' hope that this time it will be different. This time we have a president who wears sweaters and blue jeans and must therefore be a man of the people. He must be determined to have peace since he is so aggressively seeking disarmament. And he has promised us all that he will never lie. Yet in a short space of only 2 months, President Carter has succeeded in alienating and angering governments the world over. Under the guise of folksiness, he is systematically insulting visiting ambassadors with undignified receptions and by refusing to attend luncheons given by the ambassadors. He is preaching to the world about human rights while doing nothing whatever about the violation of our own human right to breathe clean air free of contamination by Soviet plutonium attacks, among other things. In the case of the Soviet Union, with whom he says he wants to negotiate arms reduction to prevent war, he is breaching an agreement not to interfere in one another's internal affairs that was signed by President Nixon back in 1972. He says he wants peace, but the circumstances he is bringing about with great speed are exactly those that could well lead to war. The fact is, my friends, that Jimmy Carter is sweeping us along swiftly toward nuclear war one, and the sooner the better, according to his Rockefeller bosses. Does he himself know where he has taken America by following orders? Bear in mind that he is conspicuously trying to emulate FDR in every respect, right down to launching his campaign last summer where FDR did in 1932, Warm Springs, Georgia, and reviving the fireside chat as president. And listen to Carter's own words from a recent fireside chat, and I quote, "I remember another difficult time in our nation's history when we felt a different spirit. During World War II, we faced a terrible crisis, but the challenge of fighting against fascism drew us together. I believe we are ready for that same spirit again." Unquote. The Rockefeller brothers want very badly to have nuclear war one begin as soon as possible, for several reasons. The military balance is shifting ever more rapidly in favor of the Soviet Union and away from the Rockefellers, even in the realm of secret superweapons. As of now, according to all the information I have been able to obtain, the CIA undersea supermissiles in the Atlantic and Pacific, which I revealed 2 months ago in audio letter number 20, are still the most awesome nuclear missiles in the world. But as I revealed then, these CIA missiles, which are to protect the Rockefellers, not you and me, have become inoperative in several cases, and there is no way to predict how long those that remain will last before they too fail and start leaking. But there is another, even more basic worry the Rockefellers must think about. As of now, the United States has no anti-missile weapons at all, and the Soviet Union has only the Galosh ABM, whose effectiveness against ICBMs is questionable. But that situation is on the verge of changing drastically very soon. Major General George Keegan, Jr., who retired on January 1, 1977 as head of Air Force Intelligence, is a man who has repeatedly been first to detect major new developments bearing on the military balance. He has said recently, quote, "A global conflict is in gestation," unquote. And, my friends, he is right. Furthermore, he has been sounding the warning that the Soviet Union is already testing a death ray-type weapon called a particle beam. Once this weapon is operationally deployed, in the very near future it could destroy incoming missiles and render the Soviet Union invulnerable to any ICBM attack, including an attack by means of the Rockefeller CIA undersea super missiles. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union is continuing right now in a relentless program of planting underwater missiles along the coastlines of the United States and other countries around the world. And in spite of the Red Friday Agreement of October 1, 1976, which I revealed in monthly audio letter number 17, the Soviet Union is not honoring the nuclear safe zone in planting these missiles. The Rockefellers believe that the threat of their CIA undersea missiles will prevent the Soviet missiles inside the nuclear safe zone from actually being launched in nuclear war I, but that is strictly a gamble on their part, because the threat is there. During the latter part of this month, I have been receiving reports from my own intelligence sources about the current status of the worldwide Soviet program of planting short-range underwater nuclear missiles. When I recorded monthly audio letter number 15 last August, I gave the coordinates for 64 missiles and bombs around the world, including 16 in American and Canadian waters. That was sufficient to give the Soviet Union the capability of a surprise knockout punch against all the naval power in the world opposing the Soviet Union. But now, thanks to the insane Red Friday policy of the Rockefellers, the situation has been allowed to become far worse. Now, redundant targeting ensures that any such Soviet attack has a very high probability of success. And in addition to naval and other military targets close to the sea, Soviet underwater missiles are now being aimed as well at increasing numbers of non-military strategic targets. As of my latest tally, the Soviet Union has so far planted a total of 372 nuclear weapons, mostly missiles, but a few bombs in coastal waters of the world. Of these, nearly half, 158, are planted in American waters. This includes 130 around the mainland 48 states, 9 more around Alaska, 15 in Hawaiian waters, and one each at Midway Island, Guam, Christmas Island, and the north approach to the Panama Canal. The Soviet Union is also preparing to be able to strike with additional plutonium cloud attacks against America. On March 1st, America extended its territorial limits to 200 miles and Soviet submarines have moved out beyond this new limit. But now, remote control canisters are being planted along our west coast within 3 to 5 miles of the coastline. So far, 16 of these have been planted and more are on the way. There are 29 missiles around the British Isles and 11 in Canadian waters. Europe and the Mediterranean are currently surrounded by 46 Soviet underwater missiles. 10 of these are in the Mediterranean. Along the Atlantic and North Sea coast, Spain is targeted by 1, France by 3, the Netherlands by 5, and West Germany by 6. 3 Soviet missiles have been planted in Danish waters, 7 near Norway, 6 near Sweden, and 5 near Finland. In addition, 7 Soviet underwater missiles surround Iceland. These are ready to decimate NATO air bases there, enabling the new Soviet supersonic long-range backfire bomber in its naval version to interdict all our vital sea lanes across the North Atlantic. The rest of the pattern worldwide is, first on the Pacific and Indian Oceans, Australia 7, New Zealand 6, New Guinea 4, Philippines 6, Indonesia 6, Malay Peninsula 2, Thailand 1, Burma 1, India 1, Taiwan 3, Red China 7, border between Red China and Vietnam 1, Japan heavily targeted 19, South Korea 8, around Southwest Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, Caspian Sea coast of Iran 3, Persian Gulf coast of Iran and Saudi Arabia 5, in the Oman Gulf 1, target Iran, Red Sea coast of Saudi Arabia 2, Black Sea coast of Turkey 1, Southern Africa 8, and along the coast of Latin America, Mexico 11, Guatemala 1, British Honduras 1, Nicaragua 1, even though Nicaragua itself is being used for certain naval purposes by the Soviet Union. Costa Rica, 3. Venezuela, 4, including one in the Orinoco River. Chile, 5. Argentina, 1. The British possession of West Falkland near southern Argentina is also targeted by one Soviet missile, as is the island of Bermuda. The government of any country I have named may obtain the navigational coordinates of the threatening Soviet underwater missiles from me upon official request. Up to now, only one government, that of Great Britain, has requested these latest coordinates, and I have gladly supplied them. Great Britain is quietly living up to her majestic name, because alone of all the nations on earth, the British government is fending off the Soviet naval threat with grim determination. I do not think it would be in the best interest of the British people for me to tell you all the measures being taken in this regard, beyond the fact that the Soviet missiles are being removed from British waters. But I will tell you that the British are proving one very important fact up to now. Given the will to do so, the Soviet war threat can be staved off. For all their modern weaponry, the Soviets are not supermen, except in comparison to the treasonous jellyfish who control America's government today. What is necessary is to recognize circumstances for what they really are, and then to summon the spirit and determination to do what must be done. And that, my friends, is exactly what the British are doing right now. Topic number 3. A few days ago, the Reverend Billy Graham was quoted in newspapers as saying he likes, quote, symbolic gestures made to the American people, unquote, by President Carter. He expressed particular pleasure at the fact that Carter not only plans to go to Sunday school, but even to teach there. But as for the substance of the new administration, Dr. Graham said it is just too early to assess that. Millions of Americans are placing their trust in Jimmy Carter, an untried newcomer to national politics, mainly because of his Sunday school teacher image. In the rush-rush world of today, Jimmy Carter's highly visible piety almost seems like something out of the past. 100 years ago, the following words might have been written about him, and I quote, "He became a regular attendant at the Erie Street Baptist Church, and vigorously did Jimmy give himself to his work. Jimmy was publicly baptized in the fall of 1854. Not long after, Jimmy was made clerk of the church, an unusual responsibility for a mere youth, and indicative of the impression of maturity and responsibility that he gave to others. Before many years passed, he was teaching one of the largest classes in the Sunday school. As a bright high school graduate, a faithful attendant, a most staid and responsible young man, Jimmy soon took a prominent part in all church activities. He threw himself into them with characteristic single-mindedness. As we have said, the church offered this unemotional youth an outlet, while it also offered his mother, brothers, and sisters the best part of what social life they enjoyed." Unquote. My friends, I did not just make up these words to fit Jimmy Carter. I have simply substituted the name Jimmy for the name John in excerpts from the biography of John D. Rockefeller, Sr. by Alan Nevins. The striking thing about John D. Rockefeller was that his vigorous church activities never, throughout his entire career, translated into fair, honest, or ethical dealings in business. And in a similar vein today, Jimmy Carter, whether he realizes it or not, is preaching good but doing evil. How far might some dictators, past and present, have gotten if they had eliminated church opposition by themselves going to church? It may be that Jimmy Carter is being misled and is not knowingly doing that which is evil. But either way, my friends, that is no excuse for the rest of us to blindly follow along like sheep to the slaughter. If we do so, history shows clearly what will happen. The end of the world came for the organized church in Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. Within a few short years, more than 20 million Russians met death at the hands of the Soviet government. And while a struggling underground of believers has persisted to the present day, the Church as an organization that can influence events directly no longer exists. And it will not exist so long as communism remains the official religion of the Soviet Union. In mainland China, too, the same thing happened when Mao Zedong took over. The Church in China was much smaller as a percentage of the population than it had been in Russia, but its fate was the same, the end of the world, aside from a struggling remnant of believers forced underground. After killing more than 60 million of his own people, Mao succeeded in turning communist China into perhaps the most rigidly regimented society on earth. And David Rockefeller, who made Jimmy Carter president and calls the shots now, has expressed strong approval of this state of affairs. For example, several years ago he said, and I quote, "The social experiment in China under Chairman Mao's leadership is one of the most important and successful in human history." Unquote. Now, my friends, if we allow it to happen, we are next, America and the whole Western world. The elaborate plan, which I revealed in Monthly Audio Letter No. 6 for November 1975, is being revised and updated for application in the present circumstances. Certain of my sources have expressed great concern to me recently that a provocation for war in the Middle East is now being established that will be unlike anything we have ever seen before. I repeat, the Rockefellers are increasingly desperate to get nuclear war one underway before they lose what control they still have over events. To achieve that purpose, plans are being seriously considered which, if carried out, could instantly throw all three major religions of the Western world into turmoil in the course of igniting a Middle East conflict. My hope is that by warning you of the existence of such plans, I am making them too dangerous for the conspirators to carry out. But in case they are carried out, I hope that you will now be able to recognize it immediately when it happens. We must not allow ourselves to be tricked, stampeded, or neutralized, my friends. We have important work to do. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.